us are free. None of us are Jordan. None of us are free. No, I swear, your salvation isn't too hard.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. and indiebay.org/Santa Cruz for the Santa Cruz Independent Media Center. I'm speaking with Paul Kivel, author of Wealth, Power, and Class, You Call This a Democracy, Men's Work, Uprooting Racism, and others. And we were just discussing the consciousness, the bridge between consciousness raising and the white anti-racist movements and momentum and movement building. And I wanted to ask you about that moment that's elusive for some folks, that aha moment, that awakening, which can't exactly be predicted, but a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to provoke. There is a certain amount of study and consciousness raising and just factual analysis that can bring about that moment, but it remains, of course, different for each individual person, and I wanted to ask you about that.
You're raising an important question, but I'm not sure that that's exactly how I would talk about it, because I think that, you know, we very much work out of a Christian model in this society of we'll run people through, we're missionaries for justice, we'll run people through some intense experience that they'll have a moment of enlightenment. They'll see the light, become converted, and then go out and get involved and be one of the faithful. And I don't actually think that that works in reality. I don't think it's also healthy or respectful or useful framework. You know, when you think about the civil rights movement, African Americans organized all over the South and then in throughout the North as well. Some white people responded and joined them and started working with them. And most white people were on the sidelines. And some were actively, you know, preventing change. But a lot of white people didn't see themselves as involved. But the more it went on, the more visible the organizing was and the clashes and everything, white people had to face a moral choice. You know, they had to decide, which side am I on? Am I really in favor of civil rights, or am I part of the backlash? Am I going to fight this? You know, they didn't necessarily make this choice explicitly or consciously, but they were faced with a moral dilemma. I think that that's how change happens, is that people go out and organize and start to protest in ways that make it impossible for things to continue the way that they've been. And the majority of folks then have to face a moral dilemma. You know, what do I stand for? Who do I stand with? What am I going to do about this? And in some ways, that's not... It's a very different kind of process. The emphasis is on organizing and putting pressure on those in power and then inviting people to step up and join that, rather than emphasis on going out and just kind of broadly doing education and converting large numbers of people and trying to change consciousness around an issue. And I think the former we know works, not always, obviously, but we know the latter... there's not much sign that that turns into a movement for social justice. And yet that's often what we see as our role, is to kind of this kind of broad-based, vague education or consciousness raising.
Rather than concrete action and
organizing.
Organizing, yeah. And actual involvement.
Right. Now, once you start organizing, then, you know, if you're organizing around a issue of racial justice or any kind of justice, then you look around and say, okay, well, what people do I need to build relationship with, to bring on board as allies because they have critical positions or critical resources or connections? Then you start saying strategically, if you're a white person and you're organizing, you know, around an issue of social justice, which white people do I need to address, or which white people do I need to challenge, or which white people do we need to bring on board as allies? And so then there's some very strategic discussions about which white people and where and how and why. But we have to be clear about what the goal is and what we're doing, and then we can make decisions about, you know, strategies for reaching white people. And I think it's the same thing with gender. I mean, often people come to me and say, how do we get men on board to stop male violence? And my first response was, well, what are you trying to do? What's your goal here, you know, in the next couple of years or 5 years or 10 years or whatever? And then from that, which men do you need to be allies, to step up?
Mm-hmm.
And then we can talk about tactics for getting them involved, you know, or... But first, the organizing has to be happening, and the goals have to be clear, and then the strategies, you know, can follow from that. You can pick and choose and sort out which strategies make sense.
So thinking tactically and thinking realistically about what goals can get accomplished is often a challenge. It's obviously a valid challenge, a necessary challenge. But when we're tackling such big targets as racism and gender violence, and we're coming upon these same some of the pitfalls and that we're going through and that we're mentioning, obviously a failure to plan maybe is perhaps the first one, a failure to think as you just laid out in terms of strategy and realistic goals and making sure that we're all ready to think about how to actually accomplish them rather than acting without a concrete goal in mind.
Right. I mean, we have to start with a vision. I mean, often we're against racism, we're against male violence or whatever. We don't have much vision about what we're trying to create, you know, what kind of communities we're trying to build. So that's going to make it hard to invite people to join us. But out of that vision, you know, we're generally a small group of people in a particular area, and we may have a big vision, but ours is just a small piece of making that happen. And so in this group, in this area, over the next 3 to 5 years, what's our goal? What are we concretely hoping to get done? And then we can start with thinking about strategies. You know, the answer to how is usually why. You know, why are we doing this? And if we're clear about why we're doing it, then the how is much easier to figure out.
So another of the pitfalls comes in that process. Often the intersections between intersecting oppression of again, gender violence or racial violence or this privilege or that privilege, particularly white and male, to name them. Where do you see the intersections? Because your work largely there's a good deal of work on race issues and a good deal of work on gender issues specifically, which we haven't addressed in large part yet in this discussion. I want to ask you how, in your experience, and in addition to your writing, like you're saying, beyond to the actual action part, I want to stress that while you've written some of these books, they come from your experience leading men's groups, leading workshops, and doing this kind of the actual work. Men's Work is the title of the book. I want to touch on the intersection between people resisting and fighting against patriarchy and fighting against white supremacy.
I think that, unfortunately, often people see those as two different issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the history of the United States, we have a patriarchy, we have a system of white supremacy, we have a ruling class, and they're all the same people. You know, we have a white male Christian ruling class, and it has different impacts on different groups of people within our society. But there's no issue you can point out and say this is only a racial issue or this is only an issue of male violence. And so it, you know, unless we start from that understanding, inevitably we make a little progress in one area and we lose some at the same time in another. You know, women made a lot of progress around issues of male violence in terms of battered women's movements, sexual assault prevention movement, etc., but at the expense of locking up a whole lot of men of color and, you know, contributing to a criminal industrial complex that, in fact, has been devastating. So, you know, we can't, every time we ignore an issue or a complexity or an interrelationship there, some group of people is getting not just marginalized, but abused, but, you know, further violated. So, you know, and that's why I think it's really important that we listen to the leadership of women of color in particular, because their everyday lived experience is not divided into, you know, gender and race and class. It's all connected. It's all interwoven in their daily lives. So they tend, you know, to come up with analyses that are integrated, that are based upon that understanding, whereas, you know, for many of the rest of us, we're more tuned into one issue or another based upon our personal identities and backgrounds, but it's much harder to keep the coherence of it, the totality of how this society works in front of us.
And along those same lines, we're again talking about identifying well thought out strategies and identifying goals and targets for change. We've talked about, you mentioned, you know, the corporate structure or the you named it the white male Christian ruling class, and have come back a couple times to saying, well, in your local communities, then how do we address this?
Right. And it's a constant dialectic because we have to be working on very specific issues and campaigns and projects, and if we're doing that without it being within a framework of the larger picture, then we're not increasing our own or other people's capacities to work for the long-term root change that we need to make in this society. So we have to be able to go back and forth and understand those connections between the totality of what we're up against and the necessity to mobilize around particular issues of survival in our communities.
So specific to the book Men's Work, I want to ask you, as I did when we first started talking about how Uprooting Racism came to be written and published, I want to ask you to talk about the history of Men's Work a little bit and how that came to be a project and came to be published as a book.
Men's Work really came out specifically of the work that we did at the Oakland Men's Project, which a group of us in the late 1970s, responding to the women's movement, were getting together to talk about our lives and relationships and what worked and what didn't work, and realized that a lot of what didn't work had to do with how we were socialized to be men. And at the same time, we were, you know, talking with women on the front lines of dealing with male violence, and a group of us decided we wanted to do something to respond to that. And so we went to some of them and we said, you know, what can we do? And they were very clear. You know, they said, we're dealing with the survivors of the violence, but it's men who are doing the violence, and you're men. So, you know, do something with the men. Unfortunately, a lot of men who heard that at that time started setting up batterers groups or counseling programs or, you know, working with men individually or in groups. And for those of us at the Oakland Men's Project, we realized that we were talking about institutional change, we were talking about broad-based education and prevention work, and that it was important to do the direct service work, but that wasn't where the roots of the problem were. And so we set up the Oakland Men's Project to do prevention and education and mobilization work around issues of male violence. And we started getting called into schools and working with young people as well as adults and men who were violent and just men in general in the community. And So men's work really grew out of the work that we were doing at the project around focus on issues of male violence, as well as, you know, at about the same time in 1980, my partner and I had our first child, who was a boy, and then we had a girl, and then we had another boy. And so it wasn't just about going out in the community and working on these issues, but also coming home and doing the daily negotiation around how do we build a relationship between us that was equal and powerful and healthy, and how do we raise kids of both genders that are going to be able to take a place in the world as leaders, as you know, with a commitment to social justice, with strong, healthy sense of themselves and relationships and what the world's really all about. So men's work came out of my experiences and our experiences doing that work together over those years.
And how is the publication of the book received?
It's always been received very well, both that and Uprooting Racism, because both books have a lot of exercises after every section. There's questions to ask. There's exercises to do. I meant them to be not just about the issues, but really practical tools for being able to move oneself in a group and to think about how to get involved in ways that are useful and accessible. So, and I think people respond to that, because so much of what's written about these issues is abstract, it's academic, it's filled with jargon that doesn't make much sense, and it's not very helpful.
And so the idea is to make it a catalyst, a spur to get involved and do more work.
Well, not just a catalyst, but a tool so that when people are catalyzed, they have some things to use to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then even more specifically, we started developing some curricula, both for adult men, but also for working with teens in schools and in community settings and criminal justice settings and, various very concrete, specific curricula for folks to use to implement some of this stuff.
What I'm hearing is from both men's work and from Uprooting Racism, the same directive that in talking with oppressed communities, there's the same directive that you do some of this work amongst your communities. I've heard it from people of color again and again that in response to the question, well, what can we do? That you go organize amongst some white people, that you do some of this work yourselves rather than waiting, as you mentioned at the beginning, than waiting for someone else to do it.
Right, I also hear them saying a lot, you know, there's various specific kinds of support we need for our organizations and our work that you can provide. You can raise money for our work, you can show up at our rallies, you can do various kinds of direct support work. And in addition, or in parallel, there's the work that we need to do in our own community. So they're not saying only work with your community. They're saying, you know, that's a piece of it. And
exactly.
The other piece is we need direct support for what we're doing.
Yeah, and so I've talked with folks who feel like there's a contradiction there that you touched on there, that there sometimes people misunderstand that and what white folks hear or what white men hear often is go organize white men and then get this question, why aren't your organizations made up of people of color or why are women underrepresented in these organizations, and feel like there's a contradiction there.
Right. And you can't work with your own people if you're not accountable to and involved in some way with organizations on the front lines of the struggle. So it's a contradiction to separate them.
Exactly. You mentioned the curriculum. I wanted to ask you about the workshops and the projects specifically in schools and with young people, because we've talked a little bit about parenting your own children, and about the adult type of activist projects and organization and movement building and such, but I wanted to ask you specifically about your work in schools and in public schools in particular with regards to actual frontline education work. What are these curricula looking at, and what kinds of things are they addressing?
There's two levels that we've worked on. One of the core things is we talk about, if we're going to do violence prevention work of any sort, we have to look at the roots of what we call the tree of violence. And very often people are up in the branches pruning, responding to interpersonal situations, you know, gangs or domestic violence or bullying or drug abuse or, you know, all those things that people, especially in social services, get pulled in to respond to. We know, though, that the roots of the violence are economic inequality, racism, sexism, adultism, environmental degradation, that our work has always been focusing on how do we deal with the roots, how do we attack the roots while dealing with the interpersonal, you know, relationships and situations. We started out being called into classrooms to especially to deal with situations of violence, and with a general model that we were out there to try to change people's behavior and consciousness. You know, that we'd go into a classroom and we were trying to get the men to stop hitting their girlfriends. We'd start, you know, try to get the young women to stand up for themselves and take care of themselves and each other. You know, it was a one-on-one kind of a conversion model. We did hundreds, probably thousands of classroom presentations and things like that. And we realized that it's just like providing any kind of social service. You can provide education in a social service model, and it doesn't lead to social change. It doesn't add up. It's a magic point to turn into a critical mass and you know, transform things. You have to be working with the institutions. So that sometimes, in some places that means a classroom, some places it means a school, and some places it means a whole school district. But you have to be addressing all the things that hold that violence and that culture in place. And so, we stopped doing the individual presentations and started working with teachers and administrators and school districts and trying to raise the skill level and the consciousness and the ability of adults to intervene as allies for young people, not just in individual situations, but in the institutional situations in which young people mostly have to try to survive. And so our curricula are both tools for, you know, classroom use in terms of looking at issues of racism, sexism, economic inequality, adultism, that kind of thing, in terms of violence, but also tools for educating adults in positions of authority and leadership. What does it mean? What do young people need? What does it look like to intervene as an ally in organizational, institutional settings?
And specifically dealing, you mentioned male violence and you mentioned in schools, and specific to violence and violence prevention. What about institutions like healthcare, for example? I mention that because we're talking about, you know, organizing our local communities. A little bit about what's going on in Santa Cruz is there's some momentum along those lines of identifying concrete steps and to address institutional racism in Santa Cruz County. There's a coalition that has been working over the course of the last year to pool resources and work together amongst a slew of organizations countywide, calling itself CORE, the Coalition to Overcome Racism. And one of the goals, a target identified, is trying to get healthcare workers trained, as an example, getting some education as healthcare workers in how discrimination happens in the industry, how relative communities have totally disparate levels of care and health in general, mm-hmm. and how people are impacted and treated quite differently in their experiences with healthcare. So, what would that kind of a curriculum look like from your perspective as someone who's been doing, these workshops for years and years and years?
Well, I don't think it looks. I mean, there is curricular aspects of that, training aspects that that need to look not just at racial disparities, but the intersection between race and gender, for instance. You know, what are the particular ways that young Latino men or young Latino women get targeted by the system or mistreated or inadequately treated by the system? So, you know, there has to be lots of breakdowns there and things like that. But what's really needed, I mean, workshops and trainings of consciousness raising only work if they're part of a long-term strategic plan to actually change systems
mm-hmm.
or to change organizations. And so there needs to be, first of all, some specific goals, outcome goals, that those around the disparities that exist in terms of those diminishing in certain concrete and specific ways over time with certain people accountable and responsible for that, and then an assessment of what are the things that keep those changes from happening and a really systematic strategic plan around how that's going to work for the next 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years. What are the steps? The path to get to the outcome goals that are in place. So, the curriculum is one piece of it, but what we're really talking about is a plan for organizational or institutional change, and who has to be at the table, who has to be in leadership and involved with that, what are the resources involved, what's the commitment, what are the concrete outcomes that are going to be expected, who's going to be held accountable if they're not, etc. There's just a lot of specific kinds of things that are involved that are way beyond curricular. You know, then the curriculum or the trainings or the workshops become a part of that larger strategic plan.
Mm-hmm. And so, exactly, you identify a target group and hold a workshop, and what often happens is there's an expectation that will work. That aha moment again that we discussed earlier has taken place, and now everything continues on, and the institution remains. And perhaps some of the people involved have actually been made more aware of their practices. Perhaps as they move about in their jobs or in their daily lives, they question their own actions more. Perhaps not. But again, the institution remains without any measurable change and without any accountability for whether the goal has taken place or not, whether there's been any measurable actual outcome.
Right. And you know, part of the assumption in terms of making people more sensitive and aware and more multicultural or culturally appropriate or culturally sensitive, all those phrases, is that those people are going to remain in power and decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a counter assumption to change. you know, cultural sensitivity implies that people who come from outside the community are going to remain in charge of the resources and the decision making. So unless there's a clear understanding of that in a larger framework, it just reinforces people's sense of entitlement and privilege.
So, it sounds like a cultural competency workshop or a diversity training in that case can backfire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also it tends to make people feel complacent that they've now had that workshop, they can check it off and go on to the next issue.
They've got their diploma.
Exactly, and they're certified.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you another of the targets. Then another one of the areas identified by the coalition here locally, and of course, it's an issue in your community and all the listeners, your community as well, of law enforcement and racial profiling and targeting in general, and that disparity in treatment, sentencing, the prison industrial complex that you mentioned as well. This is obviously a everyday reality. And oftentimes the proposal there is similar, that we have some kind of training or workshop for cops. Even when cops get totally busted, oftentimes the reprimand is sensitivity training, or that's put on the table as a as a solution. What's your response to how to tackle issues of law enforcement in that case?
Well, I think they're similar in some senses, that there needs to be long-term specific outcomes that people are held accountable to, and when they aren't accountable, then there's serious consequences. If just a handful of police around the country were actually brought up on charges of murder for crimes against civilians, when they of the hundreds of incidents that happen, that would begin to shift the culture really dramatically, really quickly. As long as there's no accountability, if the police are in general protected, immunized, slapped on the wrist, sent to sensitivity sessions, whatever, and are not accountable to the communities that they're working in, then things are not going to change. So again, it's about outcomes, it's about accountability, it's about real clear message that we are no longer tolerating the operations they were. That would drive out a lot of people from the police. It would change the culture really quickly. It wouldn't take very many cops in jail to send a message across the country.
So times is tough, like corporate collapse from many perspectives is upon us here. That has disparate effects as well. And basically things might be getting a whole lot worse for certain people, and maybe just a little bit smaller impact on others. Oftentimes, learning from our nation's history, the depression or recession or collapse of this or that corporate industry, and we're seeing it in the daily papers headlines here, is built on the backs of workers and people of color and women of color, while that same ruling class that we keep discussing, that white male Christian ruling class, doesn't feel that same impact, shall we say. Every community faces these realities, but the realities that we were just discussing, and with regards to partially to Santa Cruz again, but every community faces these. I wanted to ask you specifically about Oakland, about how Oakland is reacting and what is happening this year and this month and today in your community.
I'm not sure that there's anything dramatically different. In this country, the working class has been in worse and worse financial straits since the late 1970s. Wages have been going down, opportunities have been drying up, jobs have been shifted overseas, etc. More and more people without health care, more and more people without retirement benefits, all of that kind of stuff. And that accelerates or decelerates, depending upon the economic cycle of capitalism, but it's all been downhill pretty much, except for a couple of short periods. And part of that has been tremendous gentrification because of the extreme concentration of wealth in this country, which also is not a new thing, but it's been exaggerated over the last 20 or 30 years. It means that, when well-off white people want to live someplace, they can go and live there. They can change neighborhoods, they can change cities, they can move to the suburbs, or they can move back to the city. They have the money to make what they want happen and to elect the officials that will support that and to, fuel the kinds of economy that they want. And that's been happening in Oakland as well as most other places, which means that poor people are driven out of the cities, that people of color, low-income people of color are driven out of the cities. And there's a variety of different kinds of responses to that, and I think Oakland, again, is pretty typical that there's a lot of organizing around that. There's not a lot of leverage because in most cities, the decisions, the power is not localized anymore. It's national or international. It's both corporate and ruling class, and decisions are not made, you know, by people with any commitment to or investment in any particular local community, and it's hard to put pressure on them because of that. So, you know, we have a situation where there's a lot of struggle going on in Oakland to build affordable housing, to, you know, work for green jobs, to slow down the gentrification, all of that stuff. But it's very difficult to be successful at a local level when the decision-making is happening at a national or international level. Which is not to say there's not anything that can be done and that people aren't doing, but, you know, and there's been even be national campaigns around everything from organizing hotel workers nationally rather than locally to, you know, the Right to the City campaign that came out of New Orleans, groups in different parts of the country talking about gentrification and various kinds of direct action and strategic plans around, you know, preventing further gentrification in many areas. So there is beginning to be more coordination on a national level, but it's often very difficult locally because the local officials and even local corporate leaders don't necessarily aren't the ones calling the shots.
Well, I asked you that because of exactly what you said before. It isn't that different. It isn't. I mean. That nothing drastically different has happened in Oakland than in other communities, as you started the answer.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine talking, you know, just reading the paper and talking about, again, pending corporate collapse, financial calamity, said, oh, yeah, poor people are news all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. That you know, things are certainly getting worse. But in certain communities, unemployment ain't no new thing. Like, this is nothing new that people are having trouble scraping by. For a lot of folks.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely, in a time like this, it gets worse, much worse for a lot of people. I mean, there's just so much fewer resources in the community that a lot of people are being killed by a financial crisis like this. I mean, there's just no way to avoid understanding that if you understand how the system works. With as many people as we have without health care, with many homeless people, and many people at risk, this kills people, to put it, you know, as bluntly as I can. And the magnitude of that is greater than ever before, but it's not news in the sense that this system kills people all the time. That's part of the effects of capitalism and the tremendous inequalities of wealth and resources that is built into it.
And this is happening on a global scale. Of course, we've largely, mm-hmm. you and I have largely focused on your town or my town or our communities, and what makes up our communities oftentimes means we're identifying as citizens of this particular nation. But with the globalized economy, we can make this as macro as you want to, or as micro as you want to, where what we're talking about is racial oppression, and we can touch on something as specific as gentrification in a neighborhood of Oakland, or as general as the ongoing militarization and resource extraction of the entire continent of Africa, and what that looks like on a race level and on a race basis. When we talk about that again, that myth or the false notion of progress, that things are better, you don't have to dig very deep about the interests at stake in certain industries or in certain political movements or cadres in exploiting the global South, or pick a nation on the map, or a country of color in general as a whole. And so they're obviously interconnected. They're obviously part of that same capitalist system that you are calling on. So how do we make those connections clear in that strategic thinking and that larger campaign sense of this is going to be a long struggle. This is going to be something we need to plan out and think about and consider. How do we make that connection clear between something localized and in our community street by street and something global on a scale of an entire continent and what that looks like?
I think that the way we did that in the 60s and 70s was by understanding and supporting and identifying with liberation movements and resistance movements around the world, and that we need to do that more now. That we are part of international struggle, and there's tremendous resistance, quite successful in many areas. I mean, we need to be talking about what's going on in Venezuela. We need to be talking about what's going on in Chiapas. We need to be talking about what's going on in villages in South India and shop floors in Korea. We need to be sharing the stories of how people are resisting the same system in different places. And what does that look like? And what are they building? Because, like you said, it is all interconnected. And we tend to be pretty parochial here. And it's not easy to find out about stuff. And our progressive media often is so busy telling us how bad things are in different places that they don't actually give us a very good or complete or inspiring story of how people are working to change things.
Or when we do see it, it's not with much context. But
right.
What do you mean by parochial? Why are we so parochial?
Well, we talked earlier about this sense that America, the United States, is so special. It's got a special role. It's got a special destiny. Where, and even progressives can fall into that. You know, we're the most radical, the most vanguard. We have the best analysis, and yet we're inside the empire. The resistance is all around. I mean, the empire, it's a declining empire. But it's holding on most here. this might be the last place that we will see glimmers of real change, but we already see lots of manifestations of change around the edges. We just need to constantly make sure that we understand and support and are connected to an international context, whether it's a working class, a laborer, international labor movement, international environmental justice movements, or international liberation movements, because without that, then our solutions become inadequate or exploitive, and we're not really challenging. We're not going to the roots of what we're up against.
And when we look to liberation and resistance movements internationally, though, we see quite often a different set of tactics on the table and adopted and in use. And as we look out at what's successful and what's not, and then look inward at what's successful and what's not, first of all, it depends on your definition of success, whether you're trying to overthrow a state and put another in its place, whether you're trying to create autonomous communities, whether you're trying to simply have control over the resources that are around you that you need for survival, et cetera. But the different tactics that are used and the different tactics that people feel are realistic to incorporate, to adopt, and in some cases to appropriate, how can we do that with the same consciousness, and the same ability to think critically and be self-aware about issues of privilege, both skin and gender privilege?
Well, I don't think there's any simple answer to that.
I didn't think so either, but...
we have a lot to learn from people in other parts of the world, and we have to then come home and apply what we can and develop the strategies that work locally and that are consistent with that. But unless we're using an international framework, what we end up is we end up with an anti-war movement that's about getting us out of Iraq but not questioning American imperialism, so that people are will not be any less prone to support the next war.
Or the concurrent war. We're getting out of Iraq in order to put more troops in Afghanistan. Yeah.
Right, right, or in Colombia. And so we need, that's, you know, we tend to compromise a lot for what we think are short-term gains, although often even the short-term gains are illusory. But we need to be building, because this is a long-term struggle, we need to be building the capacity of people in general so that they have a framework and a vocabulary for talking about the roots of what's really going on, not just the symptoms. And we can do that organizing around anything, but if we're not doing it in that kind of international context, in that kind of root-focused way, then we're not really increasing people's capacity to sustain long-term work for social justice.
But a bit of devil's advocate position, it's tough to it's tough to tell someone who's earnest and well-intentioned, who wants to act in solidarity with liberation struggles and to follow the leadership of people of color, and to look outward for examples and act in solidarity with the Zapatistas of Chiapas when they can't act in solidarity with, or haven't yet acted in solidarity with the Mexican immigrants, in some cases from Chiapas, that are in their neighborhood and mm-hmm. in their, the, who are their, not just their border neighbors in terms of nation, but their house neighbors in terms of the fence. And
right.
So,
well, and that's why I think it, you know, I mean, we have to have that international framework, but the work is local and the tactics have to be local. And that's what it means to bring the work home. is that we can't substitute an international focus for local accountability, basically.
And that challenge is one that leads people to, ideally, to concrete, well-thought-out tactical campaigns that have concrete goals, measurable results, and accountability, but sometimes not.
Yeah, sometimes not. I mean, but a lot of those campaigns are going on. They're being led by local communities of color, and there are just very few white people who are really out there involved with them. I mean, you know, there's no lack of organizing going on in communities of color. What there's lacking is enough white people stepping up and saying, "What do you need me to do?" And how can I be most effective? And you know, what's next? So again, you know, I mean, we can try to figure these out abstractly, these questions about accountability and tactics and everything, but there's already people moving ahead with this stuff. We need to get on board as much as we can and roll up our sleeves.
Well, that's exactly the point that I want to start to close with as we come toward noon here. Just to point out for listeners that are listening live, coming up next on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman spent a chunk of time this morning talking about a documentary film and a project of people who are trying to document and find some accountability for groups of white vigilantes that straight up hunted following Hurricane Katrina, who traveled from out of state armed in some cases and have publicly gloated about shooting anything that moved, and that anything that moved was in large part African American men. And so just in terms of some current context of what we're discussing, and that documentation, that bursting that bubble of progress, I would encourage people to stay tuned and hear some of that information. In addition to all that stuff that, you know, I played a little bit of audio. with things that bad, I don't want to sound like I'm without hope, but with things that bad, and with things looking perhaps to get worse, what you're saying is incredibly important, that this is organizing that is going on. I want to repeat that. There is no shortage of organizing in communities of color for survival, for progress, for change, for progress. And so for folks who are listening, you know, I don't want to give this big, like, go out there and get involved push, but, it's imperative that something change, that what you're saying is that, there is a shortage of white folks rolling up their sleeves and doing the work. So,
well, and it's not a question of going out there so much as we already are located in a community where we live, in a workplace where we spend a lot of our time during the day, perhaps in a religious congregation. If we have children or if we're a student ourselves, we're in a school or a university or an academic setting. You know, there's already things going on around us that we're complicit with and have opportunities to get involved with. So it's not even abstract in terms of going out. It's we're already someplace. It's a question of looking around and seeing what the issues are and how people are dealing with them and organizing around them and saying, okay, well, what's my role? You know, what can I contribute here, and how can I work with others to make a difference?
Well, this has been quite a discussion. I want to thank you for your time and your work, and encourage folks out there to do just that, to counter this invisibility of the organizing and of the people themselves who are doing this essential work, this vital work, and destroying the complacency. And exactly what you said, that it's not about going out. It's about overcoming the paralysis and figuring out what we can all do to contribute.
Thanks for having me. I just want to let people know there's lots of resources on my website. There's articles and exercises and books, and it's www.paulkivel.com. And they can also get in touch with me through the website if they have comments or feedback or questions or just want some feedback on what they're doing.
Paul, again, I want to thank you very much for spending some time here on Free Radio Santa Cruz and for doing all the work that you're doing. I appreciate it, and I know that others and that listeners do as well.
Glad to be with you.
Right on. Have a wonderful day. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. That was, again, Paul Kivel, author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Social Justice, Men's Work, and other works, curricula. Again, that website is paulkivel.com. That's spelled Paul, P-A-U-L, Kivel, K-I-V-E-L, paulkivel.com. This is the Indie Newswire, and I must say this is perhaps the last Indie Newswire. So I want to thank you for listening and for supporting the program in the past, and I will be on Free Radio Santa Cruz simply in another role and in another time slot. So stay tuned and check out the archive and on the website, and you can get this program if you want to share it or let other folks know about it. I will post it to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz in the next few minutes. So stay tuned for Democracy Now, and thank you for supporting Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.
This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend. It was the loveliest party that I've ever attended. If anything was broken, I'm sure it could be mended. This is where.